And the court will proceed to the second case of the day. All right, our second case is Mertz v. Williams. Ms. Penson?
Yes. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Geneva Penson. I represent the petitioner appellant Anthony Mertz. Mr. Mertz was convicted of the first-degree murder in an Illinois circuit court, the first-degree murder of Shannon McNamara, which occurred in June of 2001. This appeal does not contain any claims pertaining to the charged offense. He was sentenced to death for the charged offense, partially on the basis of aggravating evidence that he committed a second murder, the murder of Amy Warner in June of 1999, and also on aggravating evidence that he committed, that he started a fire, alleged to be an arson, at the Unique Apartments construction site. Mr. Mertz's claim relative to the aggravation of the Amy Warner murder and the Unique Apartments fire is that his counsel was ineffective for failing to present any evidence to refute or otherwise challenge that aggravating evidence, which could have been easily challenged. And then Mr. Mertz has another claim, which I will address here if the time permits, relating to his sentencing counsel's failure to present evidence in mitigation that Mr. Mertz that antidepressants taken by Mr. Mertz, along with alcohol that he was consuming regularly, had a combined effect of intoxicating him, so that either it was a mitigating circumstance in the charged murder or actually served as a defense under Illinois law, the defense of an involuntary intoxication.
You know, before we assess whether counsel's performance was prejudicial, I'd like to address whether counsel's performance was deficient. His trial counsel put up a vigorous mitigation case with 25 witnesses, including experts. There was vigorous cross-examination of the state's witnesses. When we assess counsel's performance as a whole, what really was deficient?
Well, there is a lot of evidence that counsel thoroughly investigated the charged defense and put on a case in opposition to the charged defense. There is also a lot of evidence that counsel thoroughly investigated mitigation. There was a mitigation specialist assigned to do the mitigation case, Barry Hargan, and he did a lot of investigation into mitigation. But the evidence here on the record regarding counsel's performance tends to show that investigation of aggravation, of the aggravating evidence, simply fell through the cracks. There is an affidavit presented by the investigator retained by counsel, Jack Smith, and that's in the state court record at Supplemental Post-Conviction Volume at page 819, indicating that he never did any investigation relating to the aggravating evidence at all. So when you're looking at, we're not looking at the charge defense here. Pardon me?
Yeah, because what I'm trying to, I guess, well, I mean, would it be fair to say that counsel's failure to challenge the Warner murder evidence, for instance, was a strategic choice? Because if counsel wanted to challenge that evidence, the jury would have seen a trial within a trial on another appalling murder, and the state would have brought in even more evidence to rebut Mertz's accusations against other suspects. I mean, doesn't it seem as if counsel might simply have been trying to avoid making him look even worse?
No, there is no good argument that counsel could have made a sound strategic decision not to challenge the evidence of the Warner murder. There was no hiding the Warner murder from the jury. That evidence was out there. It was extensively presented by the state only from one point of view, that is, Anthony Mertz brutally murdered Amy Warner, as well as the woman in the charge defense, Shannon McNamara. By challenging that evidence, presenting evidence of alternative suspects...
Well, excuse me, counsel, let me... Were all the details, you say, how egregious it was and so forth, did those details come in, or was it just a fact of the prior conviction?
There was no prior conviction. It was an uncharged offense.
So they did bring in just bad acts.
Yes, that's correct. They brought in details about the killing of Amy Warner. Pardon me.
But so, there would have been many more horrendous details, would there not have been?
I'm not sure that that is true. There was a great deal of evidence regarding the Warner murder already. The evidence, the way it was presented, only left the conclusion that Anthony Mertz did this. Well, there were a number of alternative suspects who had just as much evidence implicating them, or even more of a motive to kill Amy Warner, including her ex-boyfriend, Chad Cox, who, like Anthony Mertz, made some admission to a friend that he had killed Amy Warner. Who had the motive to kill Amy Warner in that there was bad blood between them. They had broken up. She had become pregnant with a pregnancy that he didn't want. He denied paternity of her child, and Amy Warner was consistently threatening to ask for child support, which he did not want to pay. Chad Cox... even though he didn't want a serious relationship with Amy Warner and had another girlfriend, was jealous of the fact that she had moved on and started seeing other people, and he continued to have an ongoing sexual relationship with her that he wanted to hide from his then-current girlfriend. He had much more of a motive than Anthony Mertz to kill Amy Warner, but the evidence against Chad Cox doesn't stop with the motive. Chad Cox, had a lengthy phone call with Amy Warner on the night before she was murdered. And then he was the first to encounter Amy Warner in the morning when he went there at 9:15.
Yeah, forgive me, but is there any evidence in the record from Mertz's original trial counsel regarding the decisions not to challenge the Warner evidence or the unique apartments fire evidence. Did you depose trial counsel?
We did not. Depositions generally are not taken in Illinois post-conviction proceedings. This particular post-conviction challenge was dismissed on the pleadings.
Yeah,
there were no depositions taken. The record is silent as to counsel's reasons for not presenting evidence to refute the Amy Warner aggravation. However, we do know that counsel didn't even bother to investigate that Amy Warner evidence. That's from the Jack Smith affidavit that I previously mentioned to you.
Let me just take you somewhere, because I'm afraid your time will be up, and I want to be certain of something, and that is this. Am I correct that the Illinois Appellate Court did not expressly vacate the post-conviction trial court judgment?
The appeal was dismissed as moot,
right,
which has the effect of vacating the trial court judgment. But the Illinois Appellate Court did not rule on the merits of the post-conviction judgment.
No.
That is accurate.
But I've been wondering why we were not treating that judgment as preclusive.
Under this court's decision in Braun versus Powell, I believe it is, which is cited in the briefs, 227 F3rd 908, there is no preclusive effect. The state court judgment has no preclusive effect where there has not been a judgment on the merits. Now, the dismissal of an appeal as moot does not qualify under the federal habeas statute as a judgment on the merits. And therefore, the federal court has de novo review on habeas. There's no deference owed to the state courts in this situation.
Ms. Benson, what did defense counsel do that you feel was appropriate in explaining the defendant's background?
In terms of mitigation?
Mitigation.
What did defense counsel do? Well, defense counsel certainly presented a lot of information in mitigation regarding Anthony Mertz's family history,
right,
of being abused, neglected, sexually abused. She also presented a great deal of evidence regarding Anthony Mertz's history of being a Marine, his history of drinking alcohol to the point where he would black out. She certainly presented, they certainly presented a lot of evidence, right, in mitigation.
Well, the reason...
However...
Oh, go ahead. I'm excused.
Okay.
You finish.
However, it was very important to tie together when looking at Anthony Mertz's culpability for the crime or his worthiness of being sentenced to death, that Anthony Mertz was taking medication, Paxil, which in combination with his excessive use of alcohol had a very intoxicating effect, one which could be used as a defense under Illinois law, a defense to the substantive crime charged here.
Would you say anything was presented as to his mental condition?
Was there anything presented? There was general information presented as to him having depression, some sort of psychological issues, but there was evidence that he was so drunk he didn't remember the activities which occurred on the day or the night of the McNamara murder.
The reason I ask, would you allow the possibility that the position that defense counsel took regarding the Warren murder?
The Warner murder?
Warner murder, excuse me. That maybe defense counsel facing, it's the issue is death at this point, right?
Correct.
Conviction is over.
Correct.
That as horrific as both murders are, that perhaps that a strategic decision was made that to have that played out the way it did, that is the second murder incident being described, might in some way convince a jury that this person is mentally deranged, whatever. I mean, it's a tough call when you're a defense counsel sometimes on what to let in and what not if you're talking about punishment as opposed to guilt or innocence.
To the contrary, my argument, Mr. Mertz's argument, is that counsel letting in all of that unchallenged evidence about the Warner murder depicted him as a budding young serial killer. Not as someone.
No, there's no question. I respect that position. I'm just saying. Well, that's certainly a position one could take. I'm just asking in the sense of assessing whether a strategic move was made, whether defense counsel might have felt in some way, you and I might take a different approach, that having him viewed as you would say, a serial killer. In some way might mitigate to the jury the imposition of the ultimate penalty. That's the only.
Yes. Well,
you don't. I mean, I understand your position. I just wanted to share with you what might be a possible strategic decision by defense counsel.
Given the silence in the record of whether or not this, may I finish my answer?
I'll give you a few minutes for rebuttal.
For rebuttal. Given the silence in the record as to whether this was a strategic decision, I don't think that one can draw that conclusion. Had the Illinois courts wanted to assess whether or not this was strategic, they should have granted an evidentiary hearing and had counsel testify.
Thank you. Ms. O'Connell.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Erin O'Connell on behalf of the respondent warden. Petitioner in this case has failed to meet both prongs of Strickland. The initial argument was devoted mostly to the deficient performance prong, and I'll address a couple of those points briefly. The most important thing here is that counsel is presumed effective. So where counsel now is admitting that there are gaps in the record, those go against her position. The state doesn't need to come forward with evidence that counsel had a particular strategy. It just needs to appear from the record that counsel may have had a reasonable strategy. And there are definitely good reasons. I mean, the crime of conviction here was absolutely horrific. Counsel faced...
Yeah, let me ask you that about that. Am I correct that the original draw court found that all three crimes, all three, were accompanied by exceptionally brutal and heinous behavior indicative of wanton cruelty?
That is my reading of the trial court's finding. And then,
what effect does that have? What effect does that finding have on sentences in Illinois? In other words, would he be eligible for a term of years with that kind of a finding on the record?
He would be eligible for a term of years, but he would be eligible for an extended term of 60 to 100 years on the murder count.
Say it again, 60?
60 to 100 years.
62, okay.
Yeah, the range of 60 to 100. Mm-hmm. And based on the brutal or heinous finding, the court did impose an extended sentence on the sexual assault. So of the range 60 to 100, he opted for a 60-year sentence.
You know, that's interesting because I saw in the record that he was initially sentenced to death for the murder and 60 years for the home invasion. And I was wondering about the criminal sexual assault because I didn't see a separate sentence for that. Did I miss that?
I believe Your Honor is correct that he only entered a sentence on one of those two convictions.
Okay.
It's not entirely clear why he did so. He may have felt that they were related to each other or a lesser included.
Was 60 years the maximum available for home invasion?
It's under a regular term, it's 20 years to 60 for a felony like that. But once he finds brutal or heinous, then he becomes eligible for an extended term. Then for each of those additional crimes, it was also 60 to 100 years.
So he could have given him 100 for the home invasion.
He could have, correct.
But gave him 60.
True. And at that point, of course, the death sentence yeah. had already been chosen for the murder itself.
Could Governor Quinn have commuted Mertz's sentence to a term of years rather than to life without parole? Would anything in state law have prevented that?
I don't believe so. I believe that the government has extremely broad discretion in granting commutations of sentences. So
hasn't it been consistent, though, where the governor in these cases just blanket reduced to life imprisonment?
Exactly. And that's Mr. Mertz's sentence was commuted as part of that blanket commutation. It was not based on a particularized consideration of the crime that he was convicted of or the evidence and aggravation. And, in fact, he received, I think, a windfall under that scenario because...
That's what I was wondering about.
Right. So it was just part of the blanket commutation, and there was no specific commentary as to Mertz's crime itself.
What effect does an executive commutation of a sentence have on a habeas claim that challenges a sentence? Because the state court found the challenge to the sentence moot after the governor's action, and Mertz apparently didn't challenge that specific legal conclusion. Is it moot here as well? And why or why not?
The Illinois appellate courts have adopted under a separation of powers doctrine a rule that if a sentence is commuted, the sentence is now executively imposed as opposed to judicially imposed,
right.
And that the state courts lack the power to modify it. Now, this court has previously confronted this issue. I think it was in the Mata case, M-A-T-A, where the court said that does not render it moot for federal purposes, noting that there is a potential for mischief here, that if there was actually a genuine egregious constitutional violation, then the governor came in to commute the sentence, that would potentially take it beyond the reach of any court to correct. So for habeas purposes, we would concede that it's not moot.
Okay.
But the Illinois court's finding on mootness did have the effect under Illinois law of leaving intact the lower court's judgment here, which is entitled to deference under Section 2254D. The district court, while the decision was well-reasoned, I think reached a mistaken conclusion on that issue itself. Looking at cases where, in addition to dismissing an appeal, the court had also ordered that the judgment below be vacated. And People versus Bailey talks about this specifically and criticizes the appellate court for failing to do so in that case because the effect there was to leave the lower court's judgment intact. But here there's no question that the trial court's judgment on the post-conviction petition would have preclusive effect in the Illinois courts. And as such, it should be reviewed under 2254D.
What's the standard for review for us is what?
This court's review of the district court's judgment below is de novo. The court's review of the state court judgment should be under 2254D, which means that habeas relief should be unavailable unless that determination was contrary to or an unreasonable application of Supreme Court
deferential.
Precedent. Correct. I would note that it doesn't make a particular difference in this case as to what standard is employed, and certainly on the prejudice question, we have the seriousness of the offense itself. And then additional aggravation that counsel really failed to mention in any way. This was not a sentencing hearing at which the jury heard evidence only of the Warner murder and the Unique Apartments arson. The jury heard that petitioner was guilty of no fewer than 8 separate violent assaults, several of them quite serious violent assaults against women. So Randy Morris testified that shortly before this crime occurred, petitioner had raped and attempted to break her neck. On 3 occasions, he wrenched her neck from side to side. That was undoubtedly very compelling, aggravating testimony to the jury. There was also testimony from Carrie Guillory regarding a bizarre attack by petitioner in which he tackled her, pinned her to the floor, and then shoved his fist into her mouth and scratched the back of her throat. The jury was hearing ample evidence, and of course the crime of conviction here is exceptionally violent and disturbing.
This information came in, and my question earlier, I had forgotten it was not a charged or convicted crime, but rather came in as bad acts. Were all these bad acts, or were they convictions that were fleshed out by additional testimony?
These were all unprosecuted, the majority
of them. So, and if they'd been convictions, you may not have, I don't know what the Illinois law is on it, you may not have been able to get in the details then, right?
It's possible. There was one conviction that was, there were no details conveyed. It was the Daniel Coyce assault that he was convicted of.
My point was, my recollection in state law, at least in Indiana, was that you were pretty much limited to whatever the conviction was, not all the surrounding aggravating factors.
I think there's some dispute. Illinois courts are fairly liberal in finding that evidence is relevant to the sentencing determination.
Well, it's academic because they weren't charged.
Correct. Yes, none of these were actually charged offenses. Oh, and I would also note that not only did the jury hear that petitioner was guilty of continued violent, bizarre assaults on women, they also heard that while petitioner was in jail awaiting trial on a death-eligible crime, he assaulted at least two other inmates. He is so violent and dangerous that even the prison environment can barely contain his violence. And this is... He had every incentive at that point, knowing that he was potentially facing a death sentencing hearing.
He also attacked an officer while he was in the Marine Corps as well.
He did, yes. There was some evidence that he had assaulted a senior officer while he was in the Marine Corps. So just to circle back on the performance, counsel faced a very difficult task at the outset. Petitioner really has never contested that he committed the original offense, and he really can't contest it because his credit card was found next to her body, his DNA was found under her fingernails. Knowing the facts of that crime, counsel had to do a lot of work to try to make petitioner seem sympathetic enough that the jury would not impose the death sentence just for that act. And counsel could reasonably decide strategically that the best course of action would be to devote resources to developing counsel's mitigation theories. And in fact, counsel developed the mitigation theory that she is now being accused of insufficiently supporting. Counsel came up with the theory that it should be deemed mitigating or render him less culpable that he had this genetically influenced alcoholism, which was undoubtedly very severe, that potentially coupled with the ingestion of psychiatric medication may have had some role in influencing his behavior. The sentencing jury did not find this persuasive. And
under Illinois law, can that still be considered involuntary intoxication?
I don't believe so, and I just want to make a brief point about that. Petitioner in his state court proceedings never challenged his guilt in any respect. He never alleged that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to pursue this defense of involuntary intoxication. Petitioner first raised it in his habeas petition, and the district court very carefully set forth how this was a procedurally defaulted claim that petitioner had not shown any reason to excuse. The district court also expressly excluded this particular aspect of the habeas petition from his grant of a certificate of appealability. So I would argue that it's not properly before this court a determination of whether trial counsel should be deemed ineffective on the trial defense strategy. So to conclude, counsel in this case did render, I believe, exemplary assistance at petitioner's sentencing hearing. He had 25 witnesses in mitigation. It was 800 pages of transcript. There was a mitigation specialist who testified extensively about every aspect that was believed to be mitigating and how they might all fit together in the jury's consideration. She should be found not deficient.
Could defense counsel have stipulated to what the testimony might have been, or that's up to the district judge or the trial judge whether to admit it or not, though?
The testimony as to the Warner murder?
Yes, the other offenses, the bad acts cases.
I believe that would have been possible. Counsel did contest that he committed the Warner murder. It was largely based...
But I mean the bad acts evidence, where those things came out.
I think the state may still have had the discretion to at least
put
make
on the
argument.
Evidence anyway.
Right, because it's not just the fact of the crime, but really the details about these crimes that are so aggravating that just make petitioner such a dangerous individual. And in addition to finding no deficient performance, this court should also find that he suffered no conceivable prejudice in light of the crime itself and the overwhelming aggravating evidence, completely apart from the Warner murder and the unique apartments fire. We would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court denying habeas relief.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connell. Ms. Benson, you may have 2 minutes.
The state, the respondent, is taking the position that the Warner murder doesn't matter. The evidence of the Warner murder doesn't matter. The evidence of the unique apartments fire doesn't matter. Under the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court's decision in, which I left on the table, unfortunately, Wong versus Belmontes, it is cited in the brief, and Johnson versus Mississippi, those cases seem to indicate that another murder always matters. It's the most powerful evidence. It's the most powerful evidence that can be presented in aggravation, that the defendant has taken the life of another person. You can't simply conclude that it doesn't matter, even in light of the other aggravating evidence presented here. You asked the question whether under Illinois law the combined intoxicating effect of Mr. Mertz's Paxil and his ingestion of alcohol could be considered a defense. The answer to that question is yes. Under the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in People versus Hari, which is 218 Ill Second 275, and the appellate court's decision in People versus Alberts, which is 383 Ill App Third 374. So yes, under Illinois law, involuntary intoxication of this manner is certainly a defense.
Ms. Benson, do you believe that even if it had been error in this case, that a sentence other than life, he has now life without parole?
That's correct.
Right. Do you believe that a sentence other than that would have been possible?
Given the wide range of sentencing available, a term of years, 60 years to 100 years, I think that it is possible that Mr. Mertz would have been given a term of years, even if rather lengthy. He was in his early 20s at the time of the offense. It is possible he could have been given some term of years. Yes.
Well, and under the Illinois sentencing structure, are you credited for good behavior in a certain formula?
Not in a murder case.
Not in a murder case. Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yes.
So he was about how old? Mid-20s at the time of...
Early-mid-20s.
Early-mid-20s.
Yes.
And 60 would be the floor?
Yes.
So you're suggesting that he might have received a sentence that would have released him in his mid-80s.
It is possible. He was young. He does have people in his family who have lived into their 80s or 90s, according to the record, and it's possible, yes.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, Ms. O'Connell. Case is taken under advisement. And the